philosophers tend mostly just to talk to other philosophers. And barely that, actually. Peter has a wonderful ability to communicate the great ideas wisely, pungently, insightfully, courageously. And I know you'll enjoy the lecture as much as you'll be provoked, I hope, by it. So give a warm welcome this evening to Dr. Peter Kreft, our Colson Lecturer of 2007.
Thank you for that wonderful reception. At the end of my book, Socrates Meets Jesus, Socrates asks an embarrassing question to his fellow students at Harvard Divinity School. Socrates has found himself there somehow, 2,400 years forward and 3,500 miles westward, and he has thought his way into Christianity simply by asking honest Socratic questions of his modernist professors and confused fellow students, and not giving up until he found the truth. But Socrates met Jesus at Harvard not just as a dead historical figure, but as a living presence. And his embarrassing question now is this: where are all the Christians? Surely at least some people at this divinity school at the heart of Christendom must be Christians. Why are they so hidden? If Christianity is true, it changes everything. Christ's very last words to us in Scripture, in Revelation 21, verse 5, were, "Behold, I make all things new." I hope you remember that most moving line in the most moving movie ever made, The Passion of the Christ, when Christ turns to his mother on the way to Calvary, explaining what he is doing and why he has to do it, explaining the need for the cross and the blood and the agony. "See, mother, I make all things new." I hope your tear ducts remember that line as well as your brains. Christ changed every human being he ever met. He changed history, splitting it open like a coconut and inserting eternity into the split between BC and AD. If anyone claims to have met him without being changed, he has not met him at all. When you touch him, you touch lightning. Socrates is puzzled because he is looking for the burn marks. I'm currently working on a book that I think I will call Jesus Shock. It is first of all about the shock that meeting Jesus first brings. This is a unique shock, not just shock in general. Thus, I call it Jesus Shock. It's also about the cause of this shock, which is his real presence, and how it manifests itself in many different ways in the Gospels. And it's finally about some of the burn marks that he could make today in our world, both inside and outside the church, if only we dared to let him. Tonight, I'd like to explore my first point, the phenomenon of Jesus shock. Shocking is the opposite of boring. I think Jesus is the only man in history who never bored anyone. I think this is an empirical fact, not just a truth of faith. It's one of the reasons for believing his central claim and Christianity's central claim that he is literally God in the flesh. That is, of course, the ultimate reason for the shock and for the uniqueness of the shock. It is like Macbeth meeting not Banquo's ghost or Macduff, but Shakespeare. Like Frodo meeting not Gandalf or Aragorn, but Tolkien. In Between Heaven and Hell, I pointed out three empirically verifiable personality traits of Jesus that show that he is neither a liar nor a lunatic: practical psychological wisdom, moral goodness and love, and probably the most immediately arresting and visible one of all, interestingness. The Greek word used to describe everyone's reaction to him in the Gospels is thauma, wonder. This was true of his enemies, who killed him, of his disciples, who worshiped him, and even of agnostics who went away shaking their heads and muttering, "No man ever spoke like this man," And knowing that if he didn't stop being what he was and saying what he said, that eventually they would have to side with either his killers or his worshipers. For Jesus' shock breaks your heart in two and forces you to choose which half of your heart you will follow. No one was ever bored at him. They didn't have any New York literary critics or journalists in ancient Israel. I think boredom is one of our major psychological problems today, though few of our experts acknowledge this. I suspect that boredom is a primary cause of violence and war and hate. No one is bored while they are killing someone else or planning to. Do you remember how interesting the TV news suddenly became when we started our last little war? Haven't you ever wondered how much of the psychological roots of war come from boredom? Can't you just see that bored little bunch of ghostly children sitting around in the cellar of your own unconscious looking for trouble? Hey, yesterday stunk. What shall we do tomorrow? I know. Let's dress up in funny uniforms and get guns and find a big field and go out and kill each other. Yay, what a great idea. We all know the harm that boredom does if we have kids. The single most effective way to make kids behave is to keep them interested. I think this is the single most practical principle of child management. Kids will always get into trouble when they're bored. But we adults are only large kids, once you see through the transparent layers of socialization. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. So, if we are to have any hope of improving their behavior, we first of all have to get their attention. Another great boredom reliever is promiscuous sex. Our culture, like late Rome's, is saturated with sex and violence, largely because it is saturated with boredom. Habitual boredom, boredom not just with a specific task like chopping wood 10 hours a day, but boredom that's like the sky spread over everything, not only leads to sin, it is in itself a sin. The medievals called it sloth, one of the seven deadly sins. Sloth is not simply laziness. In fact, it does not necessarily imply any physical laziness at all. It means the passivity and inactivity of the will and the passions, even in the presence of the true good. In other words, it is the soul's refusal to eat its food. As violence is spiritual junk food, boredom is spiritual anorexia. Where do we find sloth? Go to your nearest Sunday morning church service, Protestant or Catholic, and then go to your nearest athletic field, amateur or professional. Compare the interest, the passion, the energy, the investment of the heart in these two places. How much soul stuff, how much of the self is invested in these two places? Full disclosure here. I'm a big God fan, but most of the time I think I'm an even bigger Red Sox fan. I make more noise about beating the damn Yankees than about beating the devil. You see, I'm an idiot. That's one of the reasons why I believe in original sin. Don't we know what's going on in church? Don't we know that we're attending a meeting of spies plotting a revolution against the prince of this world? Don't we know the great lion of the tribe of Judah who sneaks into our churches in disguise to meet us there? Apparently not. If we did, Annie Dillard would not need to remind us with these words. Why do people in the churches seem like cheerful, brainless tourists on a packaged tour of the absolute? Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we so blandly invoke? The churches are children playing on the floor with chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It's madness for ladies to wear straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. For the sleeping God may wake someday and draw us out to where we can never return. Why are we bored? What's missing? It's not pleasure. We moderns are inveterate and successful hedonists. But no amount of pleasure satisfies us if it's boring. The most total opposite of pleasure is not pain, but boredom. For we are willing to risk pain just to make a boring life more interesting. That's why we find war interesting. And also its civilized substitutes, sports and gambling, both of which are ritualized risk. That's also why the rich blow their brains out at an alarming rate, more than the poor do. Because a lot of money makes life predictable and controllable and therefore boring. The unsurprising life is not worth living. What is the opposite of boredom? Not pleasure, not even happiness, but joy. Joy always includes surprise, sometimes even shock. Joy's opposites, rage, outrage, horror, terror, are also shocks. Those who meet Jesus always experience either joy or its opposites, either foretastes of heaven or foretastes of hell. Not everyone who meets Jesus is pleased, and not everyone is happy, but everyone is shocked. Preaching is usually boring. I hope I'm not doing it now, but I'm afraid I am. But Jesus seldom preaches. What does he do instead? He dances. Ultimately, he dances on his own grave. He rises from the dead, not just on Easter Sunday, but every day forever after that, like a jack-in-the-box. The Bible is a pop-up book. To put the point in duller and less symbolic language, Jesus keeps bursting asunder all our comfortable categories and keeps transcending all our feeble expectations. He is, quote, full of grace and truth, unquote. And I think grace here includes not just something morally good, but also aesthetically good. Not just gift, but also style. He is full of the grace of a Chopin nocturne, the grace of a Michael Jordan slam dunk. He is God's supreme surprise. Everything God does is a surprise. Everything. First creation. There's no need for this. It is an utter superfluity. No pagan ever conceived the idea of the creation of all being out of nothing. When the Greek philosophers first heard of the idea from Jews and Christians, and when they understood what it meant, not merely imposing new form on old matter, but imposing existence on non-existence, they thought the idea insane. For in creation, the God who is everything and needs nothing acts as if he needs everything. He comes out of himself and creates a universe that is infinitely less than himself and yet real. He creates beings that are not being itself, real things that are really other than reality himself, thus shocking all pantheists down through the ages. Poor pantheists, they haven't read the newspapers. There's been an event called the Big Bang. We must understand how reasonable pantheism is. How could there be anything other than being? Pantheism has always tempted rationalistic philosophers, Spinoza, Leibniz, Hegel. But God is not reasonable, not in any human expected sense. God is infinitely surprising. It's closer to the truth to say that God is crazy than to say that God is reasonable. I suspect that God merely smiles when someone calls him crazy, but I think he shakes his head and frowns when someone calls him reasonable. And he creates not only matter, but also spirits, persons, other selves than him. How can there be more than one I? That's even more unreasonable. Hindus and Buddhists, I think, are not mystics. I think their metaphysics is totally reasonable. Hinduism says there is only one I, named Brahman, and Buddhism says there are none. The Bible says there are billions. Creating other spirits was crazy enough, but then he went on to create spirits that are also animals. Angels that breed and breathe, organisms that think, mortal spirits, immortal animals. Like apes, we breed and sleep and die. Yet, like God, we say, I am. We are ontological oxymorons. The very word oxymoron is a providential joke, for we are animals like oxen and also spiritual morons. Sin is the most moronic thing imaginable. It's so moronic that a rationalist like Plato found it literally unimaginable. Plato argued very reasonably that all evil was simply ignorance, that bad people simply don't know or realize that the happiness we all seek lies only in the life of goodness that they shun. How utterly reasonable this idea is. I think it takes a genius like Plato to be able to believe such a big lie as that. And then there's much more to God's craziness. He then went on to give these spiritual oxymorons, these rational animals, free will, and let them choose between himself and Satan, heaven and hell, light and darkness, life and death. And this was no charade. If we choose the enemy, he lets us do it and respects our freedom forever. How can he act so dangerously? We wish he didn't. We wish he had put up snake fences around Eden. So he let us make the most moronic choice in history, buying the devil's Apple advertisement. By the way, if you get mad at your Mac laptop and wonder who designed this demonic device, notice the manufacturer's icon on top, an apple with a bite out of it. So what did God do next? The craziest thing of all. The deed no sage, no saint, no philosopher, no mystic, no man, no angel, and no devil ever even dreamed of. He became a human zygote. Fetus, baby, boy, teenager, man, and then corpse. To do this, he first sent his angel to meekly wait for a girl's consent to be his mother. God is such a gentleman that he asked permission from his mother to be born. And God Almighty, infinite spirit, second person of the eternal Trinity, acquired a set of animal organs forever, for the ascension was not the undoing of the incarnation. And then he gave himself to our mouths and our stomachs, as well as to our souls. He saved us not by saying, "This is my mind," but "This is my body." That thing that looks like a little piece of bread. Catholics believe that's him, and so do some Protestants. I certainly sympathize with most of you who do not fully believe that. It's nearly unbelievable. The priest puts God into your left hand, and you pick up God Almighty with your right thumb and forefinger, and you swallow God Almighty, and he falls into your stomach. That's as crazy as the incarnation. I assume that all of us here go at least as far as the incarnation in craziness, even if not as far as the Eucharist, and that's totally sufficient for my point. The incarnation is 99.99999999999% unbelievable. This baby who can't even speak until his parents teach him, this man who has nerve endings all over his body and gets hungry and tired and bloody and gets nailed to a cross and dies, that's the Holy God, the Holy Strong One, the Holy Immortal One, the Eternal Word of the Eternal Creator who spoke all time and space and matter into being. How in the world can any sane human being believe that? Only because God himself gives us the grace to believe it. Not only is the fact a miracle, our faith in it is also a miracle. The miracle is the fact that an honest and intelligent Christian believes a truth that is nearly unbelievable. There is no miracle in dishonest faith, fake faith, and there is no miracle in stupid faith, unintelligent faith, misunderstood faith, which confuses Christianity with something easily believable, like there's a God and Jesus is nice and we ought to love one another. But honest and intelligent faith in Christianity is literally a miracle. Faith has to be a gift of God. So God gives us not only the truth, but also the ability to believe it. Not only a new thing to see, but a new eye to see it with. For how could we ever believe such a thing all by ourselves unless we were mentally deranged? Try to imagine approaching any pious and intelligent Old Testament Jew with a Nicene Creed and expecting him to believe it. And yet, once believed, it is the most beautiful and precious thought ever conceived. Though we did not impregnate our own mental wombs with it. For as Kierkegaard says, although it is possible that foolish little men might believe that God was as foolish and as little as they were, thus pagan polytheistic mythology, or might imagine that they were as great and wise as God was, thus pantheistic mysticism, how is it possible that anyone would think that God would love man, that the blessed God of the Jews, the perfect one, would care so much for man that he would become a man and let himself be murdered by man in order to save man? If God gave no sign, how could anyone ever suspect that? J.B. Phillips wrote a good book with a great title, Your God is Too Small. Someone should write a book entitled, Your God is Too Boring. Since Jesus was the only man in history who never bored anyone, and that was one of the marks of his divinity, if therefore your Jesus is boring, your Jesus is not the real Jesus. If it's a tame lion, it's not Aslan. The real Jesus is inconceivable, impossible, unimaginable, and incredible. In response to this divine miracle of astonishment, man has produced an almost equally astonishing miracle. As Jesus turned water into wine, we have turned wine back into water, turned the intoxicating wine of the gospel into a mushy grape jelly. He came to light a fire, and we have found a way to water it down. He came to shock us, and we have channeled the shock through lightning rods called churches. Or rather, churchiness. He came to spread his good infection, and we have found antidotes. As the antidote for smallpox is cowpox, as the antidote for a strong infection is a weak infection of the same germs, a weak infection that elicits antibodies to fight the strong infection, so the antidote for potent religion is pallid religion. The antidote for Christ is Christian stuff. The antidote for his noun is our adjective. No book ever written is more fascinating than the Bible. And almost no books are less fascinating than our books about the Bible. Nothing is more formidable and unconquerable than the church militant. But almost nothing is more sleepy and sheepish than the church dormant. Christ's words roused his enemies to murder and his friends to martyrdom. Our words reassure both sides and send them to sleep. He put the world in a daze, we put it in a doze. Thomas Day wrote a funny and perceptive book called Why Catholics Can't Sing. And it was all about the Irish and the Italians, but he missed the main reason. We don't sing about our religion because we're bored with it. I'm sure the same is true of Protestants and even evangelicals. Modernist Protestants, like modernist Catholics, don't sing because they have nothing to sing about. But biblically faithful Protestants, like faithful Catholics, have something to sing about, and therefore they do sing. They sing in very different styles, some of them musically magnificent and some of them musically abominable, so style isn't the reason they sing. They sing because they've met Jesus. When you meet him, you can't not sing, even if your voice is a crow. Napoleon's soldiers sang the Marseillaise with gusto, not because they were great singers, but because they had great faith and hope for France and for Napoleon. Luther won Germany for his Reformation by his hymns more than by his theology. Southern black slaves sang great spirituals because they had such great faith and hope. Their right foot was already in heaven, even while their left foot was on earth. Most of the world's most popular songs, the songs actual people actually love to sing, are love songs. That's why they're also songs of suffering. For nothing can suffer as love can. It is as natural for the lover to sing as for the fire to burn. Only where love and faith and hope are weak is song weak. But why is our faith and hope and love so weak? Because it's boring. Why is it boring? Keep asking the question. Why is it boring? Because it's not beautiful. Beauty is one of the three foods of the soul, one of the three most vital human needs, along with truth and goodness. These are the three things we all want infinitely and absolutely. They are the three attributes of God that our very nature tells us about. And they are the three ideals that raise us above the animals. Now, I think Christians have succeeded and are still succeeding today quite famously in the first of these two areas. Christian philosophy is the most intelligent of philosophies, and Christian morality is the most holy of moralities. But Christianity no longer produces the world's most beautiful and arresting art. Modern man is not rejecting Christianity because it looks stupid or wicked, but because it looks boring. Dull, hokey, embarrassing, square, sissified, bland, repressive, platitudinous, preachy, dreary, weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable. Its pictures are no longer moving pictures. They do not move hearts. The secular media make the magic now. I think this is a far more serious problem than most Christians think. Few Christians go into the media or the arts or see it as a primary apostolate or mission field or battlefield, but it is that. It's part of the battlefield where we lost the world, and it's the part of the battlefield where we'll have to win it back. The field is ripe for harvesting. Our world is rich, efficient, powerful, clever, knowledgeable, and incredibly ugly. We live in strip malls, and we hide beauty away in museums, instead of living in the museums and hiding away the ugliness. Our culture has filled our heads and filled our hands, but emptied our hearts. It's stuffed our stomachs and our wallets, but starved our wonder. It feeds our thirst for facts, but not for meaning or mystery. It produces nice people, not heroes. Alexander Solzhenitsyn insulted us by saying that at his great Harvard commencement address. You people aren't interesting. We Russians are wicked, but we're interesting. Beauty and the love and the wonder and the fascination that beauty elicits is an essential human need. It's not an ornament. But it is not only neglected by the masses, it is also actively hated and feared and attacked by the secular artistic community. The National Endowment for the Arts funds many diverse projects, but almost all of them have one thing in common: a fear and hatred of beauty, a snobbish contempt for ordinary human nature and ordinary people's aesthetic hunger. They're on a holy war against the holy land of beauty. They have a contract out on this saint. The anti-beauty jihadists are succeeding, largely because nearly everyone else fails to realize how important this battlefield is. It is not icing on the cake, it is part of the cake. Beauty is the child of the marriage of truth and goodness. To quote John Paul the Great's title, it is the splendor of truth that attracts us to truth, and it is the beauty of holiness that attracts us to holiness. Beauty is one of the things God is. It is the glory of the Lord, the divine beauty ancient yet ever new that won Augustine's restless heart. Beauty relieves boredom because beauty is the object of love. Beauty turns our head whenever we see it because it turns our heart. The heart is like a woman, and the head is like a man. And although man is the head of the woman, woman is the heart of the man. She turns man's head because she turns his heart. That's sexist, but so is God. Beauty is a magnet, and our souls are iron filings, and when we see beauty, we fly home. Now, no one has ever seen anything under the sun more beautiful than Christ. The ugliest and goriest movie ever made was also the most beautiful. Of course, The Passion of the Christ. Nothing is more beautiful than a saint, because a saint is a little Christ. A saint is not a moralist. A moralist is a bore. A saint is not a philosopher. Philosophers are bored. Stoics are bores. Even Socrates is a bore compared to St. Francis. Because Socrates may have loved the moral law, but St. Francis loved the one behind the law. The saint is beautiful because the saint has penetrated to the source of all beauty. No story is more beautiful than the gospel, the greatest story ever told. Tolkien calls it, "There is no story men would rather believe was true." And yet this is a story full of pain and nails and hate and blood and sin and murder and betrayal and forsakenness and unimaginable agony and death. It is the story of what happens to the most beautiful thing, perfect love, when it enters our world. It comes to a cross, to a crossroads between good and evil. T.S. Eliot called the gospel the idea of some infinitely gentle, infinitely suffering thing. Or most beautiful stories are like the gospel. They are tragedies first and then comedies. First crosses, then crowns. And they're crosses because they are conflicts between good and evil. That is the fundamental plot of every great story. To say that story is beautiful means that story resembles the gospel. If you are bored by the gospel, that puts no black eye on the gospel, but on you. Most likely it means you've never really listened to it. You must have heard it, but hearing is far from the same thing as listening. As you know, when you try to talk to a friend who hears you but does not listen, you listen to music, you only hear muzak. For some, the gospel is muzak. And not all who listen believe. If anyone calls the gospel a crazy fairy tale, a far too good to be true myth, an insane extension of wishful thinking, or even a blasphemous lie, I will respect him and argue with him. But if anyone calls it a platitude, I can only pity him, for that means he has never listened to it. Christ's beauty is a beauty that breaks our hearts. It is no beauty we could desire unless our hearts break first. This is how beauty is different than truth and goodness. Deep truth heals your mind, and deep goodness heals your will, but deep beauty wounds your heart. Deep beauty hurts. The most beautiful works of art in all of human history came from Christians. That was no accident. The connection between art and Christ is like the connection between sunlight and the sun. It is, in fact, the connection between the light of the Son of God and the Son of God. So it is the connection between sunlight and the sun. It's a million points of light from the light of the world, reflections of the Son of God in the mirror of the waters of earth. When we listen, when we have the sanity to be still, when we do one of the most creative things we can ever possibly do with our minds, namely shut up and enter the holy silence, we find there someone who has been leading us beside those still waters and refreshing our souls. That silence is not empty, it is full, like a woman's womb, or like the silence of a lion's eyes. That is my explanation for the Gothic cathedrals of the Middle Ages. They were technological miracles, you know, far, far ahead of their time, like the American moon rockets in the 60s. No one predicted we'd get to the moon that soon. In fact, the cathedrals are very much like moon rockets, heavy matter taught to fly like angels. They even look like rockets. Their flying buttresses look like rocket fins. When you look at the Cathedral of Notre Dame, you're amazed that it has remained on its earthly launching pad so long. If you suddenly saw the whole massive structure blasting off from earth and ascending to heaven in front of your eyes, you would say, "Of course, I knew it would come to that eventually." These cathedrals have been called sermons in stones, but they're more than that. They're spirit in stone. They're angels in stone. Jesus would not perform the miracle of turning stones into bread, but the builders of the cathedrals performed the miracle of turning stones into angels. Now, what in the world explains those miracles? Nothing in the world. That's what makes it a miracle. Christ alone explains those cathedrals. Stonemasons did not build them, faith built them. His real presence built them, and his real presence was worshipped in them. They were not built to house man worshipping, but Christ worshipped. They were his houses. That's why they had to be better than man could possibly do. They had to be transgressions of the possible and imports of the impossible, like the cross. They were built in the shape of a cross because they were built by the crazy love of men for the Christ whose crazy love for men had brought him to the cross. They were the most beautiful buildings ever seen on earth because he lived and loved and acted in them. And he was the most beautiful thing ever seen on earth. It's always our hearts that accept the gospel first. The beauty-hungering heart always leads the truth-hungering head. It is even the beauty of truth and the beauty of goodness that attracts us, not the mere correctness of them. The heat from a melting heart has to warm the frozen mind and the frozen will. And only the hardest heart can look without melting at that face on the cross, knowing whose face it is there and what he is doing there and what love moved him to go there and whose sins sent him there. The Passion of the Christ is the least sentimental movie ever made. Maybe that's why it evokes the deepest weeping. The world was converted by the gospel because the gospel is the beautiful love story of God's crazy love for man. And the story of the world's conversion to this love story is also a love story. It's the story of man's love for this crazy God. The world was not converted by the reasonableness of the story. The story is not reasonable. It would be more reasonable for a man to love the rebellious ants in his pet ant farm so much that he became an ant and let the rebel ants torture him to death in order to save the ants from their sins. We sinned for no reason but an incomprehensible lack of love. And he saved us for no reason but an incomprehensible excess of love. Everything in this story is crazy. Nothing is reasonable. Nothing is expected. Nothing is boring. And everything is beautiful. How can our response to this be boring instead of beautiful? How can we ossify it, mummify it, or treat Christ the tiger with spiritual taxidermy? How can we turn him into a toy to cuddle and sell? I actually saw one of those at a religious convention. Far better to shout "crucify him" than to mumble comfortably, "isn't he nice?" He is not Christ the kitten, but Christ the king, Christ the tiger, Christ the lion. And when you hear this lion roar, even if you believe it is only a myth, a Midsummer Night's Dream, you cannot not say with the good Duke, "let him roar again." Let's just look for a moment to see how the wildness of man's love for this wild lover of man blows away boredom in the gospel. It's a story from Mark 14. While he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at table, a woman came with an alabaster jar of ointment of pure nard, very costly. And she broke the jar and poured it over his head. But there were some there who said to themselves indignantly, "Why was this ointment thus wasted? For this ointment might have been sold for more than 300 denarii, that's a year's wages, and given to the poor." And they reproached her. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you will, you can do good to them, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burying. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him. Though the New Testament does not explicitly say so, the traditional interpretation identifies this woman as Mary Magdalene. Imagine that, a former prostitute adoring Jesus. Imagine that, a year's wages, and remember how those wages had been earned, wasted on a single bottle of perfume, and then the perfume wasted by spilling it out all at once on him. You don't have to be Judas Iscariot to protest this. You only have to be prudent and reasonable. That money could have saved dozens of families from poverty. Imagine a tortured but brilliant and pious homosexual artist commissioned by the Pope himself, Peter's successor, to design the central truth in all Christendom for the rest of time. Imagine half of the world's gold wasted on this church when half the world is in poverty. You see, it's the same story. And we continue to be tempted to side with Judas instead of Jesus. We know the end of his story. We know the two deeds of death Judas was responsible for, first Christ's death and then his own. The two most important people in the world to him, the only two he could never, ever escape in time or in eternity. His physical suicide came only after his spiritual suicide, which happened in this gospel story. What prompted him to betray Jesus just then? What did Mary do that was so dangerous that Judas responded it by choosing damnation? The answer in one word is adoration. That's the business of heaven, and that's the definitive and eternal answer to the problem of boredom. And if we turn away from that in disgust, as Judas did, for any reason whatsoever, however prudent and moral, then we turn from him, as Michael did when David danced in adoration before God's ark. And to turn from him is to turn from joy and from heaven. And everything except heaven is boring, because our hearts are too big for anything less. Adoration is love unlimited, love squared, love raised to infinity by the exponent of love itself. Adoration is the mountain without a summit, like Jacob's ladder that extends into the sky forever. Only God may be adored, because only God is unlimited goodness, truth, and beauty, and thus only God deserves unlimited love. Our very first and greatest commandment from him is to love him with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. If we give that love to any creature, even our spouse, we commit adultery against God. That is what idolatry is, spiritual adultery. We are commanded to love our neighbor only as ourselves, and we're certainly not supposed to adore ourselves. Therefore, we're not supposed to adore our neighbor. We must not treat anyone, whether ourselves or our neighbors, as God, by loving them with our whole heart. Now, when she was a prostitute, Mary Magdalene did not love herself or God or the men she seduced. She loved the stuff that she bought with the money. And she loved the money that she bought with her body. And she loved her body only because it could buy the men and the money and the stuff, like expensive perfume. But then she exchanged autonomy for adoration and gave her soul and her body and her life and her money and her stuff to Christ. The perfume was the stuff and the money and the men and the prostitution and her life and her heart all rolled into one ball. That's the ball she gave to Christ, like a good doggy, instead of holding on to it like a bad doggy. And that is the secret of joy. We can learn the secret of joy from our dogs. Christ tries to teach us the secret of joy through our dogs, but we don't listen. Plotting and planning and buying and selling is boring. Economics is the gray science, even though it's perfectly honorable and necessary. But giving the stuff all away is not boring. St. Francis of Assisi was bored all his life until he gave all his stuff away and became the troubadour of Lady Poverty. St. Paul used a striking word for this stuff, that is, for everything else in the world except Christ, when he called it skubala in Philippians 3, 8 through 10. It's a four-letter word in English, and it begins with S. The strong, bold, honest, and literal King James Bible translators let us know what it meant. Dung. Now, this was expensive dung. Paul had known the very best the world could offer, Roman citizenship, education at the feet of Gamaliel, the light of Israel, prestige and power among both Jews and Romans. He even knew moral success by the standards of the most morally rigorous sect of the most morally rigorous religion in the world. He was a Pharisee of the Pharisees, as touching the law, blameless. And he laid all this stuff at the feet of Christ and called it skubala. Why? For the same reason Dante could call the most beautiful woman in the world a bagel compared with Beatrice. Because love gives you eyes. Love is reasonable in the deepest sense and therefore utterly unreasonable in the normal sense. The deepest sense of reason is the rule of the three R's, right response to reality. The normal, shallower sense of reason is practical prudence. That's fine for finitude. But infinity demands insanity. The crazy love of a saint is utterly reasonable because it is the only right response to the reality of infinity. It is utterly reasonable to love the absolute absolutely. For the same reason, it is reasonable to love the relative only relatively. And it is just as unreasonable to love the absolute and the infinite with only a relative and finite love, that is, to be prudent and practical, like Judas, in the presence of Christ. That's just as unreasonable as it is to love the relative and the finite with an absolute and infinite love. That's idolatry. It's just as crazy not to be crazy about Christ as it is to be crazy about anything else. Because he is not yes and no, but pure yes. And therefore the saint loves him with a pure yes. And that is the heart and essence of all true religion. And it is utter madness by the world's standards. Sigmund Freud was honest enough to call it that, literally. The madness of Mary's perfumed adoration moved Judas to the madness of resentful self-damnation. John's Gospel notes that Satan entered Judas also when Judas witnessed two other similarly mad acts of love, Christ washing his disciples' feet, and then Christ giving them his own body and blood in the first Eucharist in the upper room. Judas saw the purest love ever seen on earth, and he could not endure the sight, so he put out his own eyes. He saw heaven on earth and could not endure it. And that non-endurance is the only reason why there is a hell. On another occasion, we see the same frantic love, fanatic love rather, in another Mary, provoking a little bit of the same reasonable prudence in Martha as we saw in Judas. But unlike Judas, Martha later listened and learned. You know the story. He entered a village, and a woman named Martha received him into her house, and she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she went to him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me." But the Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. Only one thing is needful. Mary has chosen the good portion, which shall not be taken away from her." Martha's soul is divided. It's given to Jesus, but also to stuff, and therefore to anxiety. Mary's soul is given to Jesus only. Martha is reasonable. Mary is not. Mary does not calculate about the many things when Jesus comes. She holds nothing back. She does not contracept her love. She gives him not just her serving, like Martha, but herself. She is the true romantic. She sells all her pearls for one pearl of great price, risks all her wealth on one investment. She does not use the safety net of a spiritual mutual fund. She knows the holy wildness of the one thing needful. She knows that, as Léon Blois says, in the end, life contains only one tragedy, not to have been a saint. I think that single sentence is worth more than all the other books in most libraries. That's true, not because sanctity is adorable, but because Christ is. That's what sanctity means. There is nothing, literally nothing, in the beauty of the saint but the beauty of Christ. The saint takes an infinite risk, a leap of faith, and this is beautiful, and also the answer to boredom. But the infinite risk is not the cause of the infinite beauty. The infinite beauty of Christ is the cause of the infinite risk. If Christ were dead, that leap would not be beautiful, or good, or true, or wonderful. It would be ugly, bad, stupid, and boring. If Jesus is not alive, neither is Jesus' shock. The effect depends on the cause. If Christ is not raised, then our faith is vain and we are pitiable. The effect proves the cause. Jesus' shock proves that Jesus is alive. Only a live wire can shock you. A dead wire can't. There are a lot of dead wires around, and they look perfectly good. How can you tell whether they're alive or dead? Touch them. Are you shocked? If you're not, you know who to go to.
wants to ask away first.
Why do you think that boredom is the primary psychological problem today?
Experience of myself and my kids. Every parent knows that kids behave themselves when they're not bored and they get into trouble when they are bored. I think we can learn a lot about psychology from kids. We can learn the origin of war. We can learn why the world is such a mess, because we're all just big kids.
Do you think it's more of a problem today than it has been in the past?
Yeah. Isn't that funny? Go to a place like Calcutta, where people are desperately poor, and you'll find some little kid that can't afford anything like a toy, and he'll play with a stick and a stone for hours, and he's not bored. Then go to America, where the average kid has about $20,000 worth of expensive video games, and he's bored in 2 minutes. We're bored because we got too much stuff.
Thank you.
Greetings in Christ. I appreciated your topic and your speech. A good comment on society in North America. Myself, I am not a Roman Catholic, nor an Orthodox, nor a Protestant. I am in the Anabaptist tradition. I wonder if you might give us a hint of some sort of application or hands. If we have turned our hearts, what direction perhaps the hands might go in?
Well, I think we examine our thoughts fairly frequently. We examine our actions quite frequently, but we examine our hearts less frequently. So I think we should examine our hearts, not just our feelings. Hearts are deeper than feelings. That scriptural term heart doesn't mean sentiment, it means something deeper than that. And ask ourselves the question, how close am I to the real Jesus? How much passion is there? Who said this? Josh McDowell? Sounds like Dietrich Bonhoeffer. If you were brought to trial for being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you?
Would that evidence be seen only in one's heart, or would it be seen through their life?
Oh,
and their
no,
hands?
The heart doesn't stay. If the heart stays cooped up like a seed, it dies. It pumps blood, and the blood moves the body, and you can see the difference. Why in the world did the hard-nosed, practical Roman Empire convert to Christianity? How did 12 uneducated Jewish fishermen convert the Roman world? They saw something. There are hints of it in the Bible. Look how they love one another. We never saw anything like that before. If it's just ordinary love, nice God love, good love, well, that's good, but that's not going to convert the world. Jesus said, by this all men will know that you are my disciples, by the love you have for one another. Now, that can't be the same love that we already have. That's got to be a radically different love. So if it's not different, we're not doing something right.
Dr. Kraft, some of your books were the first books I read as a new Christian when I was in college back in 1984. I remember reading about the Unaborted by Socrates series or reading Between Heaven and Hell. And one of the most helpful things to me as a new Christian was to see these arguments portrayed in a dramatic format, but then with notes along the side to kind of key me into what was occurring. And I was just wondering if you could speak to the idea of being trained to see beauty, because it's one thing to say to try to portray the beauty of the gospel to a culture, but there's a lot of people who aren't Christians who wouldn't see much beauty in the movie The Passion. In fact, many people saw much ugliness in that. And so it seems that there you have to be trained to see truth and trained to see goodness. Could you speak to our task of training the culture to see beauty before we can even show them beauty?
That's a very good question. And I don't recall ever reading a book about that or a philosopher that directly addresses that, except Plato, who says in the Republic, that's the first kind of education, music and gymnastic, bodily and soulish on the level of the irrational passions, beauty first, so that you're trained to recognize the higher and more spiritual beauty later on. So I think it's terribly important to give little kids an education in beauty. I recommend the Montessori method of early childhood education. They are very sensitive to beauty, especially tactile and physical beauty. And kids get a sense of order and the beauty of order. And they're not bored with order, as most people are.
I was just thinking there's many Christians who read something, who react to a book like Harry Potter, for instance, and don't see the unbelievable number of gospel parallels. And I think that, as you said, people see beauty and but I think many Christians don't even see beauty there. So it's like within and outside the church, not seeing these very biblical, passion-centered themes that are there if we can see them.
Yeah. I think most of the Christian imagery there is unconscious. I don't think the author is a Christian. I don't side with either the people who say it's a wonderful Christian allegory or the people who say it's a terribly dangerous apologia for witchcraft. I think it's just a good pagan myth. But it's very well written, and it's quite beautiful, and it's fascinating. And if we could write art like that, boy, what good we could do. Of course, Tolkien did it, but he's dead. So somebody has to be the new Tolkien.
Dr. Crape, I first heard of you about 6 months ago, and I listened to your podcast on Pascal's Wager. It was a profound experience for me, and I've read a lot of your stuff since then. But I also read recently a book by Todd Lindbergh about, it's called, I think, The Political Teachings of Christ, and it's about the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with that book, or if you have your...
I'm not even familiar with my own podcast. I'd like to hear it someday.
If I could summarize Lindbergh's argument, it's essentially that if you can take, I don't want to call it the secular teachings, but I will for the lack of a better word at this time, and there's still real value in that.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course there is. That's spoiling the Egyptians. I don't know which of the church fathers used that. I think it was Augustine. When the Jews left Egypt, God told them, take all the good stuff that the Egyptians have lent you, and you're going to need that in the desert. Well, that's Egyptian stuff, but it becomes Jewish stuff now. So when the great medieval philosophers like Augustine and Aquinas read Plato and Aristotle, they said, boy, there's a lot of good stuff here, a lot of bad stuff too. So we'll sort out the good stuff and we'll take it with us. Obviously, God, there is such a thing as common grace. We've got to be more sensitive to that than we are.
What's the difference between beauty and humor? Oftentimes, I just picked up on that one phrase, too much of our preaching is boring. Too often, we answer that by trying to be funny. What's the difference between humor and beauty?
Humor is a minor but important form of beauty in words. And it can fall flat, just as beauty can fall flat elsewhere. And it can be very, very useful. It can do things that nothing else can do. Some of the survivors of Auschwitz said they would have died were it not for the fact that they can make black humor out of this. And when you find a really funny joke, you smile very widely and you can't forget it and you want to tell everybody else about it. And it's the same thing, exactly the same reaction when you see something very beautiful. You smile very widely and tell everybody else about it. Language is a beautiful thing, and poetry is one way of making language beautiful. Clear and powerful prose is another way, and humor is another way of making words beautiful. We're not a very verbal generation. Books are being replaced by images and squiggles on computer screens. I had one student that really terrified me. Students don't usually terrify me, but I had a lot of books assigned for this course, and a student was complaining, and he said to me, you're a professor. Books are your friends. You don't understand students. For us, books are our enemies. I said, you're not serious. Oh, yes, books are our enemies. I wanted to say, you poor, pitiful wretch, but I didn't dare.
You've actually partially answered my question. Imagine you're speaking to evangelical seminarians, okay? So in light of what you said...
That's a stretch, but let me...
Yeah.
Imagine it.
So in light of what you said about boredom and surprise and beauty and truth, what would you suggest to these evangelical seminarians how to do evangelism, how to share the good story today, both personally and congregationally?
The first answer that comes to my mind is a rather shallow and obvious one. Evangelicalism usually comes from Northern Europe, from Germany, Holland, England, and so on. Go to Southern Europe. Become Italian, Spanish, Greek. Go to Israel. Become Jewish. Let your hair down. Dance. I'm sure there are deeper answers than that, but that's the first one that came to mind.
Yeah. Dr. Kraft, in your book, Socrates Meets Jesus, at the early chapters, you mentioned the fact that Socrates notices that in today's world, we're always in a rush. We're always moving around very quickly. We don't take time to notice. Do you feel that our lack of ability or lack of desire to slow down and notice the beauty of creation is what causes us to not notice the beauty of our Creator?
Absolutely. And this is one of the main reasons for the popularity of Eastern religions, the meditation techniques. You don't need to go to Eastern religions to meditate. But we have been so lax in teaching this that when somebody does teach it, oh, that's what I need. We all need it. I find myself every month or so strangely restless. And I say, what's the matter? And I said, I haven't done nothing for weeks. So I go on my favorite rock in Nahant and I sit there for 2 or 3 hours and watch waves and I get sane again. And then I'm okay for a couple of weeks. But if you're doing anything while you're doing that, it's not really silence. We feel guilty about that. I'm wasting time. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. By the world standards, prayer is the biggest waste of time in the world.
You mentioned in your speech today about how few Christians we see in the arts and the media and such, and certainly if you browse the internet or go into a bookstore or flip through the cable channels, it would certainly appear that we've given up that battleground and said, okay, you guys, take it. I'm just be curious on some thoughts that you have on things that we can do as Christians to take that back.
There's three kinds of Christians. There's Christians that don't really love but fear the media and therefore stay out. There are Christians that don't really love but fear the media and therefore go in. And then the only effective ones are the ones that don't fear it and love it and go in and do a good job on it. So don't go in it unless you love it. If you don't like movies, don't be a movie maker. If you don't like art, don't be an artist. But there's a fear of those things because beauty, we have no defense against beauty. We have defense against falsehood. There's a little sensor that lives in our brain, and it's like the keeper of the drawbridge. And nobody can come into that castle unless they pass that keeper of the drawbridge, and that's called reason. But there's no keeper of the drawbridge by the heart. You see something beautiful, you're defenseless. It's like water that undermines the castle walls. It seeps in. That's why it's so powerful. So I guess we're afraid of that because we like to be in control. We like to have that little rational sensor saying, maybe so, let me read your book first. If so, I'll let it in the castle. If not, not. But you can't do that to something that you just hear or see. So that's scary, but that's like a lion. The difference between a lion and a worm. You can control a worm, but a worm is boring. But a lion is more interesting. So beauty is like a lion.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could comment on the relationship between what you said earlier about tragedy and beauty. It seems when you compare the stuff we really like in secular art right now with what we see in so-called Christian art, that's the biggest missing element. That, you know, if you sing, you said, the great love songs, there's sadness in them. But yet, with the exception of the Psalms or the spirituals you mentioned earlier, there doesn't seem to be much of that in our songs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as a problem? And if so, like, what is the relationship between that and beauty?
Here I have to be very personal, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but Christian music is some of the ugliest things that I've ever heard in my life. I'm sorry. And one of the very selfish reasons why I pray every single day for reunion between Protestants and Catholics is I want Catholics to sing those great old Protestant hymns. I miss them terribly. That's, you know, I'm on the couch. Personal confession, it's not an argument. But even in music, without a sense of depth and tragedy, it's boring. It's just pat on the head pop psychology.
Dr. Kraft, I found it very interesting when you talked about boredom in preaching and so forth, because when I was a kid, I was never bored in preaching, and now I'm bored quite often, and I think my own feeling is that I love the King James Bible. It's beautiful. It's got power. It's powerfully poetic. And I think, could you comment on the disappearance of beauty in language? It seems like each Bible translation that comes out is dumbing down the language more and it's becoming more prosaic.
You know, I never understood that. I wondered why the new translations were so boring. And I assumed that It was because they were done by scholars, and scholars want accuracy, and they're not sensitive to beauty and interest, so they sacrifice beauty for accuracy. And then one day, I don't know Hebrew, but I know Greek, I spent about a half a day with four different English translations of the New Testament, four, five, six, a lot of them, with the Greek New Testament in front of me, and checked out whether that was so. And I found, to my astonishment, that the most literal translation was the King James. And that all the modern translations not only take out the beauty, they take out the accuracy. It's as if Job's friends rewrote the speeches of Job. I said, what could possibly motivate this? I haven't the faintest idea. Now, I'm a Roman Catholic. We have a magnificent liturgy, the old Latin Mass, and even when translated into English, it's magnificent. But since 1962 or 65, we've had a translation which rivals some of the dullest Bible translations in the world. And it sounds like an inter-office business memo or something. And I said to myself, why is that? And it's also inaccurate. It's not a good translation of the Latin. Well, the present Pope has restored the Latin Mass as an option, so that's a step. And the King James Bible is not out of print. The RSV, by the way, was out of print. That's another good translation. That's an updating, but it's both accurate and very beautiful. The NRSV people ensured that the RSV was taken away from all bookshelves before the NRSV got allowed. I wondered why, and I talked to some of them. They said, well, we have a different philosophy of translation. We believe in dynamic equivalence rather than literal translation, and we're trying to be sensitive to what the Spirit is doing now with inclusive language, and so. So, yeah, we're not accurate, but we think we're doing good work. I said, well, then it's not an honest translation, because I don't want to know what the author said and what the translator said. I just want to know what the author said, and if it sounds clumsy, fine. He said, well, we don't believe that anymore. Well, the old translations did. And they had power. So I completely agree with you. Once upon a time, the whole world, even non-Christians, were biblically literate because everybody read the King James. Now there are 30 different translations and nobody's biblically literate anymore. The more translations there are, the fewer people read them. So if I were the Pope, I'd do this. Number one. Throughout Christendom, we have to have the Latin Mass and the King James Bible. And it would all be in tablets of brass, and you couldn't change them. And they were... I'm half kidding. Only half kidding. Yeah, our insensitivity to beauty of words and power of words is astonishing.
Would that reclaim, do you think, great preaching again if we had that poetic inflection and diction in our preaching again?
Yes, even the inflection. Chuck Colson's a great speaker because of the inflection. You listen to him, even if what he's saying is kind of boring. You know? He's more like a lion. Jesus is both a lion and a lamb. We've concentrated so much on the lamb, I think the lamb has eaten up the lion. We got to get the lion back.
Thank you.
I appreciated your lecture today. I'm a very big supporter of the arts and expression. And I'm wondering, to what degree do you consider... I've always struggled with this idea of stewardship, as I want to focus my energies on evangelism. I want to personally be a missionary and the propagation of the gospel. And I also really have always enjoyed the arts and expression and how to focus my energy. And to what degree do you see evangelism... do you see art as integral to evangelism? And then to what degree is every missionary, evangelist, pastor... an artist, and how do we develop that?
I don't see either art or evangelism as narrow specialties. I see them as dimensions of every Christian's life. We are all called to be evangelists. We're not all called to be professional evangelists. Everything we do should have that as one of our purposes. God, we want to help you redeem the world in some way or other. Now, art plays a big role in that, not simply by giving you pretty pictures for illustrations for the books you write, and not merely for having good architecture in the churches, but there's an aesthetic dimension to everything you do. I once met a remarkable person, Dorothy Day. She's sort of the American Mother Teresa. And she gave a lecture back in the 60s. And I don't remember a single word of the lecture, but I remember the art of her face. When she spoke, every molecule in her face was in every word. And every atom in her body was the perfect body language. And it was utterly natural, not at all self-conscious. And then years later, when I was in Japan, I met some Buddhists. These Buddhists were going around following a Catholic priest. They weren't Catholics, they didn't understand or believe it, but he had the same sort of body language, and they said, oh, that's what Buddha is. He's holy to his fingertips. You can tell that life is a work of art for him. Even walking is an art. And I looked at him, and there was something remarkable about this man. He didn't have a halo, he didn't walk in a special way. It's just that, well, one of the Buddhists explained it to me this way. He said there was a student who asked a great Zen Buddhist master to teach him enlightenment, and the master said, I will do it if you obey me. And the student said, I'll do anything. And the disciple said, all right, you only need to do one thing today, wash my dishes. So the student washed the dishes. The second day, same thing. Third day, same thing. After a year, after 365 days, the student said, when are you starting to teach me the secret of Buddhism? And the master said, I taught you every day, but you haven't learned. The student said, but all you told me to do was wash your dishes, and I've done that every day. The master said, no, you haven't. You never wash dishes. What did I do? You wobbled. In other words, your whole heart and mind isn't in it. You don't have full attention. It's not to you a work of art. It's just a thing you do. For most of us, life is like that. Now, to restore the dimension of art to all of life, to say that everything you do is a work of art, not in an artificial way, but in an actual way, that would be a tremendously powerful tool in evangelism. So I think you can do both.
Dr. Crape, you said that the most beautiful thing in the world was a saint. And I think if we asked everyone here what's a saint, that we would come up with at least 65 different definitions. And we all hold certain people that we know about to be saints. But I'm wondering, what are you talking about when you say the most beautiful thing in the world is a saint?
That's a very easy question to answer, because all 65 of these people would agree with the answer. A saint is a little Christ. The more like Christ you are, the more of a saint you are. That's the absolute standard. In most questions, there's not an absolute standard. Here there is. And it's very concrete. Now, the church is like a Christ-making machine. Just as the university is like a Socrates-making machine. That's to put it crudely. But the whole purpose, as C.S. Lewis says in Mere Christianity, of every single penny ever collected in church, and every single Bible ever printed, and every single janitor who ever swept dust under the pews, is to turn men into little Christs. And if it's not doing that, it's not doing anything.
Hi. As we go out to minister or teach in an increasingly pluralistic society, I was wondering how you would respond to a question we might get as we present this to people of other faiths or people who are pluralistic. They'll say something like, maybe, there's a lot of beauty. I see a lot of beauty in Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam, the Quran. How do you account for that beauty? Is it coming from God, or is it some other source, or what is that?
Of course it's coming from God. He's the origin of all truth and goodness and beauty. And, as a Christian, I'd say more, it's coming from Christ. No man knows the Father except through the Son. Now, if you accept that, there's only two possible explanations for the beauty or the truth or the goodness of a Muslim or a pagan or what. Either it's fake or it's from him, but not recognized. I see no reason for saying that God is holding back on his common grace and giving it only to Christians. So I say that all the truth that you know is God's truth, and all the goodness that you seek is God's goodness, and all the beauty that you experience is God's beauty. And you don't fully know God. That's why you should become a Christian. But everybody partly knows God. Even the atheist knows God. That's why he's worried.
Good evening, Dr. Crave. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous right now. My brother, who's a student here, introduced me to your works probably about a year ago and became a big fan. And he called me about a month ago, said, guess what, Dr. Crape is going to be giving a talk, Gordon Conwell. So I flew up here all the way from Houston, Texas to meet you.
That's a long way. My goodness. Welcome to the hub of the universe.
I am Roman Catholic, so I wanted to ask in your opinion with respect to joy. There are many times in trials and tribulations, as well as our evangelical brothers, I'm sure, can sympathize that the role and the responsibility of a Christian, especially in today's secular society, is becoming, which I believe increasingly more challenging. In those times where we do find our trials and tribulations, where we tend to get depressed sometimes, or maybe downtrodden, or whatever, there's this conflict that occurs between that and the joy of the Lord in our hearts. In your opinion, in those times, is it okay, or do you believe that the Lord would understand in those times that maybe perhaps we may be a little distant from God, or there may be times where our sentiments are that of which we, because we don't understand them, there may be some upsetness there of particular trials in our lives, that the Lord in His grace would understand that, and that maybe we don't feel very positive towards the Lord when we should have joy in our hearts? And I just kind of want to see what your thoughts are.
I'll go farther than that. And this is not my authority, but all the saints that I've read say this. At that moment, you're probably closer to doing God's will than any other. At that moment, you're going by pure faith. There's no crutch. There's no emotional help. You're like Jesus on the cross saying, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But you're still praying. Like Job. Job's prayers were crazy. His theology was wacky. He was wrong. But he was praying. The three friends' theology was correct. They weren't praying. Job was closer to God than they were. And God, when he showed up, said to the three friends, you didn't speak rightly about me. Wait a minute, my theology was correct. I knew more than Job did. Yeah, but you didn't pray to me. Now, sometimes, not sometimes, very often, when things are going well, we don't pray much. We all got foxhole religion, parachute religion. So when God gives us trials and tribulations, that's usually, maybe that's always. Of course it's always. Only because he loves us so much that he's giving us a kiss. And he's like a grizzled old man with a beard, and we're like little kids, and the beard hurts when it scratches on our face, but it's a kiss from him. Now, the wiser you get and the more saintly you get, the more you can do what great saints like Paul do. Enjoy your tribulations. That's difficult, but that's what we're called to. And we can do that a little bit, especially if when you have no tribulations at all, you don't have any joy. When everything is going well, you're bored. No challenges. That's the worst thing in the world. Compare Brave New World in 1984. I would much rather live in 1984 than a Brave New World. Under a totalitarian dictatorship where you've got Big Brother to fight, and you'll probably go down in torture and death, but it's meaningful. But Brave New World, blah, all the problems are solved. That's closer to my vision of hell. C.S. Lewis dares to say in The Problem of Pain, there may be something like pains in heaven. If so, may God give them to us very quickly. And there may be something like pleasures in hell. If so, God protect us from them forever. Pain and pleasure are increasingly trivial as you get closer to God.
Last question. What's
It's very trembly this place here. I think you mentioned about the boredom and beauty. What is this boredom? It's because we don't have the beauty here or in the church. I think it's a very insightful comment. When I'm looking back my past, I also searching for beauty, even in the church or in the study, everything, but it was very hard to enjoy or see the beauty, especially in the worship in the church. I think it's very sad, and it's the reason why people doesn't come to church. But what I want to ask you is there any your work or books you can recommend about boredom and beauty, the relationship you are talking about today?
Not in itself, no. You have to go down deeper. What's boring about a church service? Not so much that the architecture isn't magnificent, not so much that the music is not impressive, not so much that even the words are not poetic. It's the state of soul. It's the flaccid soul, the slothful soul, that's the most boring thing. So I would far rather be in an utterly unstylish church that I don't fully understand, where there's passion, than in a very stylish church. I'll give you two examples right here in Boston. There's two Catholic churches in Boston that I sometimes go to. One is St. Paul's in Harvard Square, which is a very beautiful church and a very intelligent service and very intelligent sermons and wonderful music. I just get the feeling that it's a performance. And then there's a little church down by Berklee College of Music where I used to teach. And it's dirty. and it's very old, and a lot of homeless bums come in. And I just got the sense that those people are praying their hearts out. I love the place. It's not boring. So it's not just an aesthetic feel on the outside, but by beauty, I mean the beauty of holiness. No, so you should do it.